Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome your Studcast host of television and radio fame, Tony Basilio.
Hello, friends. This is the great Brian Last. Obviously, I'm not Tony Basilio, as was just so nicely introduced here. I'm filling in for Tony this week, and I'm very happy to be here and presenting to everyone the man behind the Studcast himself, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. It's a pleasure to have you on here with me. I might say a little bit about you on the opening here. I'm going to toot your horn a little bit in case some of my fans aren't really familiar with you. Brian is the 605 man, and that's one of the absolute best podcasts probably ever done. And he's behind Arcadian Vanguard, which is the great company that that we are affiliated with and really proud to be a part of, Brian. And Brian does a great job, and I thank you so much for standing in for Tony for me, and I really look forward to our discussion here today.
You know, Ron, you've been on the Super Podcast several times, and one is just about to be out. And, of course, you've been on the Jim Cornette Experience. Geez, I don't even know how many times at this point, but the story time with the Tennessee Stud is such a big hit. It's been so much fun to hear you tell these stories. It's great to be here to hear it on your show. And today I know we have something a little bit different, and you've done this before on your show. We're not just going to talk about wrestling, but so much of your life is, you know, especially this period of time in the late 60s, was around athletics, specifically basketball. So we're going to go back into college in basketball and talk a little bit about that.
Yes, a few programs ago that we did have one program that was pretty much high school basketball, and now I want to kind of finish basketball today, or certainly head in that direction to finishing it, and explain what happened once I left high school and where it all went from there. I'm going to throw in some wrestling. Selected for the draft. We're going to talk about the time of turmoils in the late 60s in which the country was obsessed with the Vietnam War. And, we're going to cover a lot of ground today, Brian. It's going to be an unusual Studcast, not going to be filled with wrestling so much, but I've even got a couple of wrestling stories I'm going to throw in there too. And so I'm looking forward to it. And if you're ready, we'll take her away.
Absolutely. And like you said, there was so much happening in the country. I think, we don't have to sit here and rehash everything that was happening in the news and in everyone's face in the late 60s. But while all that is happening, all that social unrest, there's a lot happening in sports. And it's really one of the glory periods of college basketball, Ron.
Yes. And I think that's where I'd like to begin here, because I was lucky enough to be a part of that and to see so many different teams and to play in so many different cities across the country and against some phenomenal players. And as this broadcast goes down and we get into the meat of the matter here, I think fans are going to say, wow, I can't believe we played against those guys. So, when I graduated from high school, in that summer, I was signed to play with Clemson, and I spent my first year at Clemson. When I went to visit them, it was an odd situation. It was spring break, and so there's nobody on the campus. I didn't realize that it had been a military school, The coach, I think on purpose, didn't tell. And there was another recruit there, and he was from Pittsburgh. His name was George Sitazzolo. He actually led the ACC in scoring his senior year. Great basketball player. And he and I both were there, put into the same hotel, same dorm room. We weren't put into a hotel. We were put into a dorm because it was spring break. And so we are there. We didn't know that we couldn't get a feel for the university because of the way there was nobody there. We're only people on the campus, basically. And so we sign, and we talk a lot during the couple of days that we were there together. And he says, where could you go? And I had offers from LSU. I had offers from here, there, and all these places. And we talked specifically about LSU. It happened to be the year that Pete Maravich's dad took over at LSU. And Pete went to LSU, and we had a discussion about it. I said, I don't think LSU, I might like to go there. You know, I know that. And he's a guard, and Pete was a guard, too. And he says, you don't think I'm going to go there and pick for Petey for 4 years, do you, man? He goes, I want to shoot myself. He says, I'm a shooter, man. I want to score some. So he was really a great athlete. The guy was a superb athlete. Really, really good. So we go in, we both go there, and we finally say, I'm going to come here. You're going to go here? I really like you. Yeah, I'm going to come here too. So we show up there in the fall, and it's an odd situation. The first few days around the campus, I see these guys and their heads are shaved. And I'm like, and I ask him about 3 days in, I say, Butch, his nickname was Butch. I said, Butch, what's the deal with all these guys that's got their head shaved? And he said, I don't know, man. He goes, but I've seen a bunch of that too. So about 4 days in, one guy finally stops me and he goes, hey, are you a freshman? And I go, yeah. Yeah. And he goes, how come you got your hair? And I go, what do you mean? How come I got my hair, man? And he goes, it's a tradition here. He goes, this is a military school, man. And he goes, we're going to shave your hair. And I said, wait a minute. No, you ain't shaving my hair. And he goes, oh, yeah, we're going to shave your hair today. Right. And so Butch comes along and that ain't, it's a haircutting party. They get us both in the same day. They shave our head. It's like, wow, this is a bad deal. And I also noticed right away, I asked him, I said, where are all the girls? And he goes, dang, Ron, you're right. He goes, I haven't seen but maybe 6 or 8 girls on campus, you know. So I got to asking one of the guys, the upperclassmen, I said, where's the girls? And the guy goes, well, hey, this is a military school, man. He goes, it used to be all military. He goes, you know, there's very few girls here. I said, well, how many is very few, man? And he goes, I think there's 700 girls out of 12,000 people here on campus, and 700 of them are girls. And I was like, wait a minute, man. I went to Butch again. I said, what have we done here, man? I said, we're here. We've got a school with no girls. They've shaved our heads. We wear these little beanie caps. They give you a little beanie cap. You had to wear your beanie cap everywhere you went. It was like, and then you also had to take ROTC. It was mandatory. So you marched every Wednesday, wintertime, summertime, rain. I don't care what's going on. You put on your uniform. You went down there and you went through the drills and you marched. It was like, I was just like, what have I done here? I've just, why did I end up in this place? So I make it through the entire year. He's a great ball player. And I'm a pretty decent ball player my freshman year. I had one game of 31 points and 31 rebounds in one game. Pretty decent game. This kid could play. He was averaging 35. I mean, he could play ball. And so I tell him, toward the end of the season, I say, Butch, I'm not coming back. And he goes, oh, Ron, he goes, they all say that here, you know. They all say they're not coming back. And I said, no, I'm not ribbing you, Butch. I said, I'm not coming back. So he goes, you serious? I go, yeah, I'm going to find me another place to go. So I call my old high school coach, and I say, I'm unhappy there. It's just not a good fit for me. And he says, give me a week. And he calls me up and he says, how would you like to go and talk to the University of Miami? And I was like, wow. At first I said, how many girls?
Good. That's the first question I would ask too. Yeah.
You know, so it's summertime, you know, and I'm trying to transfer in the middle of summer. So I get a visit. The coach calls me from Miami and he says, do you happen to have any other players? You had a great high school team, one of the best in the history of the state. And he goes, do you happen to have any players on that team that aren't going to college somewhere? And I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I have a good friend that's about 6'5", and he's a pretty good ball player. He says, fly him down with you. He says, I want us to take a look at both of you. So we fly into Miami, and this guy's a pretty darn good athlete. And he's a pretty decent basketball player. So first thing the coach does, it's almost like he knows where my head is. He takes us into the student union. It's in summertime. So there's kind of like when we visited Clemson, there's nobody much on campus. And there's a big student union that has a pool, some pool tables that sit down on a lower level and a seating area up above where you sit up there and watch people shoot pool. And it's the coach and me and my friend Bob Duncan. From Atlanta. So, and we're living in Atlanta, both of us. So we're shooting pool, and along come these three girls, mini skirts, brown legs, beautiful girls, right? Sit down. There's nobody in there playing pool but the three of us, and they sit right by us on a platform, basically where you stand and look up there, and all you see is these beautiful legs. And I was like, gosh, I'm looking at Duncan like, wow, what is this all about, right? It's pretty obvious, right? I was going to say, this is pretty obvious what he's pulling here, right? Yeah. So we play a couple of games of pool. We decide anyway that we basically want to go to school there. So we go home, and the coach calls me back. He says he watches us play ball. He plays ball with us, actually. And then he says, I'll let you know something in a week. So he calls me back, and he says, Ron, he goes, I want to take both of you. I want to give you both a full ride. And I was like, wow, I loved it. It was beautiful campus. It's absolutely phenomenal campus. So I call my buddy up, and I say, you know, Bobby, he says he'll take you, man, full ride. And he says, Ron, he's a little hesitant. And I'm like, what is this all about? Hey, Henry, this is what an opportunity here. Yeah. And he goes, you know, I've always wanted to drive a truck, you know? And he says, all my life, I've just wanted to drive a truck. And I just got this job driving a truck. And I said, well, you know, the Vietnam War zone, man, you have heard about that, right? And I said, you know, if you go to college, you know, you may be able to avoid some of that. And so, well, you know, he basically says no. So I'm like, well, I can't. And later on, I'd like to finish this program. When we get to the end of it, there's a sad ending to this whole story of this particular part of it. But anyway, I go to the University of Miami. It's beautiful. I love it. It's just absolutely great. I love the weather. I like to tan anyway. I like being outside. Worked outside growing up as a kid all the time, living on farms and things. So I'm in hog heaven. It's beautiful women. It's 12,000 women, 12,000 men. It's perfect, right? I was like, hey, I'm going to get a date here, you know. At Clemson, they said, the guys used to say, I'd say, well, how do you get a date? And the guy goes, you probably won't till you're a senior. You got to be here for a while because there's not many girls here. So anyway, it was a good switch for me, and I really loved the city and the beaches and all that Miami had to offer.
Well, girls, I mean, you could just start and stop there. Going from Clemson to Miami, that seems like the big difference right there. Those legs, I mean, you can keep describing those for the rest of the studcast here. But I am curious just to ask you a brief wrestling question here in the middle of the story, Ron. So here you are in Miami, and of course your family has ties all over the wrestling world, but specifically the Southern wrestling world. Do you ever reach out? Do you ever go to a show? Do you go to do you meet Chris Dundee? You know, do you ever have any involvement in any of the shows down there while you're going to school?
Yes, I do. And what happens is my dad is highly involved in Georgia at this point. But he starts to focus on Florida because I'm down at the University of Miami now. So him and Eddie Graham have a great relationship and have had for many, many years. And that is a catalyst for them to become closer, the two of them. So my dad actually gets an apartment in Miami and starts to come and watch some of my games. He in high school, my senior year, he watched a few games. Now in college, he's going to get interested in basketball. He's going to want to actually see games and go to these different cities and see these big buildings that we're playing and that type of thing. And so I, yes, went down as the answer to your question, especially in Miami Beach. And that's where Dundee and all those guys were, right there in the old Miami Beach. I think it was called the auditorium at that point. There's two buildings there. And as time goes by, I'm going to come back there and be a wrestler in that area and wrestle in those buildings. But yeah, I got to meet all those guys. And we stayed, we really watched a lot of wrestling. As time goes on there, my last year, they start to run Miami more than they had before. And I was actually setting up rings and stuff like that for them for their Wednesday night matches and the different arenas and different places that they went. So I was kind of involved with wrestling at the same time as basketball. So we're doing but Miami was an independent. It was not a part of any conference. So you did not play within a conference when you Clemson, as an example, is a member of the ACC. And it had obviously, you played same teams. You had 14 teams and you traveled there. You played home and away. You didn't really get to see much of the country. Now, Miami is a totally different ballgame. We went everywhere and we went to big cities and played big teams. So I transferred from Clemson, but Clemson won't release me. They will not let me play that first year. They say, no, you left us and we're not going to release you. So I wasn't able to play in my first year there, which was 1967, 68. I sat out. I had to practice, had to do everything.
Did you look for any workaround? I mean, obviously, you know, whenever you've needed help with wrestling, you always can have, you know, your dad or someone there who can walk you into a television station or something. But in something like this, where you would just want to play, is there anything you can do?
No. I mean, I just basically spent the year. What I did was I hit the gym. I worked out really hard in that year. And I gained probably 30 pounds of muscle in that year by not playing ball and not running as much as I normally would have. And so I was really preparing myself for wrestling because I really did not think I was going to be a professional basketball player. I never had that in mind, but I did want to go to college. I was the first person in my family to ever go to college. And it was a great opportunity for me. So I sat out that year of 67 and 68. And then I come back in 68, 69, and I get the starting center job. I'm actually a sophomore, basically. You know, I'm a redshirt sophomore. And I have a pretty decent year. I'm a fair basketball player, but my heart's not really in the game like it ought to be. I have a wrestling mentality, I guess is what it is. I've seen I love the big buildings and things like that. I would suntan in the wintertime, big time. And I'd even use the reflectors that you put on your face so that your face yeah. got brown. Yeah. And so when we went to play, I don't care where we went to play, it's winter, everybody's white. And I would come out last, and the team always loved it. They would make me come last because I always got this reaction, instant reaction from the fans. And they would all come onto the floor. They're all white. Then none of them laid in the sun. They weren't working out. They didn't have a body and they weren't brown. And when I would come through the entrance, the building would like, whoa, boo, surfer boy. They'd start calling me names and they just hated me. And so it was fun for me because it was kind of like being a heel. I mean, I was a heel everywhere we went, so much so that the players got into it and they would say, boy, let's watch what happens tonight, man. What are you going to do tonight? So, and I would, if when I had a chance, I would do things to make them mad. For instance, we played Florida State, and we played against Dave Cowens, one of the great centers of all time, not just the NCAA, went on to play for the Celtics and made a huge top 50 basketball player of all time. He made the top 50 list of all time. And so I played him 2 years in a row. And the first time we went to Florida State, you couldn't dunk. Back in those days, it was during that Alcindor days, just after Alcindor, where Alcindor was dunking so much, they thought he was killing the game. He was basically making the game.
Yeah,
I thought
really.
He was making the game.
Yeah.
It was a bad thing. I thought that was a big mistake they made by taking the dunk out of the game. And so in that game in Florida State with Cowens, I dunked on Cowens. And it was illegal. I mean, they would not only did not give you the points, they would actually give you a foul. So, you know, I got the foul. I raised my hand, but I was smiling at him like, ha, 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 how'd you like that? And later on in the game, he dunked on me. He got me back. So he didn't care, right? So, but the fans just booed me. It was hard. It was really amazing. I mean, and the second year we went to play there, it was outrageous. It was like they were waiting. And as soon as I came through, they were like, oh, there he is. It was like, oh, so I was really, it was fun for me. It made my basketball days more enjoyable for me. But in that first year that I played, we played in Philadelphia. We played at these famous old basketball arenas, the Palestra. LaSalle, we played LaSalle at the Palestra, and we played Dayton up in Dayton. We played Tuscaloosa. We played the University of Alabama at Tuscaloosa. Florida State, I've already talked about. We played Centenary in Shreveport, Louisiana. Now that's Shreveport is not a beautiful spot. It's not a garden spot of America, that's for sure. And Centenary, I'd never been involved with Louisiana. I mean, you know, it was my first trip to Louisiana, and I had all those Cajuns there, you know, and those Cajuns we sat on the bench. I remember that night being on the bench at one point, and we had two guys on our team. They had their names across their back of their warmups, and one was named Nylon, N-Y-L-I-N, and the other was named Spagnolo. And I remember the guys in the stands, the people and the hecklers in the stands behind us, the college students, one of them says real loud, it's quiet in the building, and he goes, Nylon! He goes, I thought that's something you wear on your legs, right? So the place kind of laughs, but, you know, there's a couple of guys on my team, a little hot-headed guys, they'll look around like, hey, were you smart, right? They started a little banter back and forth, right? About 10 minutes later, somebody else takes this real silent time to go, Spagnolo. He goes, that sounds like a social disease. I mean, so and now my buddy on the far end, he's from California. He's like, he gets up and he turns and he starts cussing them. You know, good. And, you know, they now that we've got a little stuff going on there at the end of that game. My buddy off the bench, I think we won the game, and instead of going down the bench, down to the bleachers and taking a ride into our dressing room, he goes up into the stands after the guys that have been mouthing off, right? So I watched him, and I said, well, I mean, he's going to get killed. I got to go up there and help him. So we end up in the stands fighting the fans in the stands after a basketball game. I mean, it was like crazy. I mean, you don't see that stuff happening. And the police came up, they drug us out of there, and, you know, it was like, it was a part of that old mentality, though, that wrestling mentality. I kind of, at the end of it, man, we got in the dressing room, we were high-fiving each other, like, boy, we lit them up, didn't we, man? We had them going. So, hey, we seemed to have our fun in one way or another. We played Tulane in New Orleans, and it was Mardi Gras. Pretty nice time to be in New Orleans, right down there on, on the major drag where the parade is, right? And so we lost to Tulane that night, and the coach comes and says, there's a curfew here. You're not going to the parade. You're not going to Mardi Gras. You know, you're going to stay in your room. Nobody leaves the hotel. So me and a roommate of mine, a guy named Rick Law, he's a kind of a crazy guy anyway. He says, you know, Ron, are you seriously not going to go out to Mardi Gras? And I said, well, hell no, of course I'm going to Mardi Gras. So we're on the second floor, and there's one of those old stairs that you grab the stairs and it lowers you. It's come down to ground level. So we about 2 a.m. sneak out. We sneak out the window of the hotel where we are, and we take the little fire escape down to the ground, and we're going down Beale Street. And it's still all this crazy. It's New Orleans and Mardi Gras. And first place we go into, we want to have a drink or whatever it is. The coach is in there. So we get busted for breaking curfew, and we end up having to run. But it was kind of an example. I was a bad influence, I guess, on a lot of the players and maybe on the team itself sometimes, because I just didn't really have basketball in my heart. I was just killing time and putting in those years in college to get myself some education and to have a good time, which you had plenty of in living in Miami.
Yeah, and you wouldn't get to play heel again for another several years.
Yeah, I wouldn't have that opportunity. So after that first year, I did wrestle in that summer. And I had wrestled in the summer of 68. And last episode actually was my first match. And it was in Blytheville, Arkansas. My dad was smart enough. I told him, he says, I want you to start wrestling. And I said, I can't wrestle. I lose my scholarship. Said, you know, I can't be a pro and be an amateur, you know. So he says, well, I'll stick you somewhere where they'll never find you. And I said, gosh, man, why is this so? You need to get started, right? So he finally could. One day he says, I got you booked. And I go, and we live in Atlanta. And I said, well, where is it? And he goes, Blytheville, Arkansas. And I said, how far is that? And he says, it's probably 1,000 miles round trip. You know, so I drive 1,000 miles round trip to wrestle in Blytheville, Arkansas. Crazy darn thing. So the next summer, he gets me booked again, and he comes to me about 2 weeks before the match, and he says, got you booked again. I said, where? Mobile, Alabama. So the Fields brothers are down there, the Bobby, Don, and Lee, and those guys, that's their territory at that time. And he just wants me to get a show. He goes with me. He doesn't wrestle with me like he did the summer before. I'm in a singles match. And so I get there and I'm concerned, you know, and I say, Dad, I just don't feel good about it. How are they going to announce me here? He's going to announce you as Ron Fuller. And I go, well, some people might be able to tie that in with Ron Welch, with the Welch name. And I'm playing ball as Ron Welch. I said, I want a mask. Could somebody get me a mask? So they go and find me a mask to wear. And so they come and ask me my name. The ring announcer says, what's your name? And I said, hell, I don't know. No, I've got a mask on. I don't know what my name is. So Dad looks over there and he says, oh, he says, call him Paul Bunyan. You know, like the old, the big old ox and all that thing, right? Paul Bunyan, he was big and the whole deal. So anyway, I go out and I wrestle that night. I don't get caught. So I've got 2 summers there that I have wrestled. I've given my dad his little happy moment to see me in the ring. And he sees that I'm probably headed in that direction of where I'm going to want to do that. Let's go back, Brian. We talked about the social issues that were going on. The Vietnam War was a big thing in the late 60s, and yeah, there was a lot of protest and things like that. So I'm eligible. Hey, I'm in college, but I'm still eligible for the draft. In fact, I'm 1A. So they call me for a physical to go down. I drive down to downtown Miami. I go in there and they've got guys standing along the wall there and they're putting them through these things and this stress test and this type of stuff and that type of stuff. So they get to me and they have the old scales in which you stand up on the scale and it has the thing that you raise up to check your height. And they put it flat on the top of your head see how tall you are. Well, about 6'6", those things come out of the holder. When you're above 6'6", they keep raising it and then it comes out of the holder. And so I get on there, they weigh me, and then there's two army guys. And, they said, okay, let's check this height. And the guy starts pushing the deal up. He's raising it. And then it comes out of the holder. And he holds it down there beside it, and him and the other guy they're messing with me big time, right? He goes, what do you think? I think he's 6'5", 6'5½". I said, wait a minute. I said, this thing comes out at 6'6", and it's out now, right? I go, I'm 3 inches taller than that. I'm 6'9". So I argue back and forth with them, and finally they say, okay, you can slide off there. You're too damn tall. You know, they were upset, and we're not going to get to send you to Vietnam. You know, you're too tall.
That would have been crazy, you at 6'9", running around the bush in Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, how do you hide in a foxhole? How do you dig yourself a foxhole when you're 6'9"? They got no uniforms for you. Nothing fits you. I mean, I assume that's why they did not take tall guys. But I had that experience of going and being turned down for the draft because of my height. And then I come back to play the next year, 69 and 70. We played great teams that year, absolutely phenomenal teams. In fact, we played the number one and number two teams in the NCAA. They end up playing each other in the national championship game. We play, one of them is UCLA, the other one is Jacksonville. And there's a tournament at the first of the year, two tournaments. We play in Pittsburgh early in the year in a four-team tournament. And we end up winning that tournament. And I play against two centers. I don't remember their names, but they were 7 feet tall, 2 7-foot twin centers. They're twins. So you couldn't tell which guy you had, who was in there and who was on the court. And they really wanted to be physical. I mean, you know, and I like to play that style. I fouled out of most games because I was banging all the time. And one of them was running down the court, and he hits me in the back and the kidneys really hard. It's like, and he gets away with it. They don't see it. So I'm waiting for him to do something else during the course of the game. So I got that I've still got this mentality where I just can't hardly, I don't want to be a basketball player. I want to be more physical. And we then play a tournament after that. Biggest tournament probably I ever played in. It was the four Florida schools, Florida State, University of Florida, University of Miami, and Jacksonville. Jacksonville has a guy named Artis Gilmore. He's 7 feet, a legitimate 7 foot, 2 inch guy. Great basketball player. Florida State's got Neil Cowens. These are centers that I'm playing against. University of Florida had Neil Walk. Big time star back in the day. They all go on to be big time stars. Another guy I end up playing is Steve Patterson on the UCLA National Championship. I think it's John Wooden's fifth championship team in a row. Sidney Wicks and Curtis Rowe and Henry Bibby and John Vallely. I mean, a fabulous team, those guys. Jacksonville's got Artis Gilmore and another 7-footer. A great team. So we're playing in this tournament, and these guys go on to be huge stars. Patterson goes on to play pro ball. Obviously, Neil Walk goes and plays for the Phoenix Suns. He becomes the first Phoenix Sun basketball player to ever have his jersey retired. You've got Artis Gilmore, who plays in the NBA and the ABA for 11 years. It becomes a Naismith Hall of Fame player. And then you've got Dave Cowens, who's an NBA star, becomes a top 50 player all of the NBA history. So, you know, playing against some really good talent in that Jacksonville tournament. Now, my dad is there to see that game, see that tournament. And he flies in from Atlanta. And in that game, I get it half court, I guess, and the guard steals the ball, and he starts driving for the goal. And I'm the only guy that's got any shot at cutting him off. And so it's got the old backboards. It's playing in Jacksonville Coliseum. It's the portable backboards, and they bring them out there. It's got the pipes that hold up the backboard itself, and they've got these little small areas. It's a dangerous looking thing if you look at one of those, you know. So I'm trying to get this, cut this guy off and then keep him from scoring. And when he goes up to hit, to take a shot, then I can't stop myself. And I hit him with a shoulder. He's a guard and he's a small guy. It drives him into those pipes. He goes head first inside the pipes. You know, it looked like it killed him. And the crowd went, boom, it was a big pop, right? Everybody in the building came up on their feet. And Jacksonville, two games earlier, had a big fight with whoever they were playing, made national news. So I knew about the fight. I knew they were fighters, that they weren't going to take too much. And so I hit the guy, and I accidentally hit him. I didn't intend for that to happen, but it shot him into those pipes. It looked like he killed him. The crowd jumps up on their feet. And so I got my back to their bench. And I don't want anybody coming and hitting me with a cheap shot in the back of the head or something. So I turn around and I square off at them like a wrestler. Fists are doubled up, like, come on, right? Oh, it's another pop. This one is a bigger pop. And like the whole crowd, whoa, geez, he's challenging them. So here they come, the whole team. So we almost get into a thing there, and they throw me out of the game. Because they can't get control of the crowd. I mean, the crowd won't stop. They just won't stop. And God, I got the suntan, and they've already been on me from the very first time I come through, and they can see me. Now I'm a real heel. So, and they take me down and set me on the end of the bench, make the announcement. Ronald Welch has been disqualified from the game. And, the crowd won't let them start the game. They just continue to boo, and they start throwing things at me. And the cups and stuff are coming out of the stands, and the crowd is just, they make, please, ladies and gentlemen, you know, we want to continue the game. They ask for them to control themselves a little bit, and it just gets worse. That just makes it worse. And so they finally come down, the police, they send two policemen, and they come and get me and walk me out of the building and back into the dressing room. So my dad's up there. Oh, when I get the games over and we get together that night, he's like, "Ha, damn, boy, that was great, man." He goes, "That was super. That's the type of thing you need to be doing." So, you know, it was like, he really enjoyed it. It was a nice little spot, I guess, for later on in the year. Later on, the last game of the season, we're going to play Jacksonville. We're going to have Artis Gilmore there again. And my dad flies down because he remembers the first Jacksonville game. He goes, "You going to play them same, the Jacksonville?" "Yeah, I'm playing Jacksonville." "That big guy, Artis Gilmore." "Yeah, well, yeah, Artis Gilmore." He goes, "Oh, man." He goes, "I'm flying in." He goes, "I want to see that." And so he spends the day with me. I go have lunch with him. And he says, "You know, Ron," he goes, "I know how you can make a huge name for yourself tonight in this game." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, Dad, what are you talking about?" And he goes, "Well," he goes, "you know that Gilmore," he says, "you know, everybody knows him. He's a big star." You know, he goes, "I'll tell you what you need to do." He says, "When he's coming down the court, you know, at some point in the game, and he's not expecting it," he says, "you just step in front of him and you scoop slam him. You pick him up and slam him on that court." He goes, "It'll make national head." He says, "You'll be the biggest star in America." That's my dad's
phrase. Your dad's booking the game.
Yeah. He was like, "Yeah, just go ahead and let him have it, man. Just slam his butt." And, you know, I just right off, I said, "Oh, bull, Dad, I can't do that. I can't do that." And then I spent that whole day thinking about it. You know, I said, "Well, you know, gosh, I mean, I'm going to become a wrestler, and that's a pretty good way to get my name kicked off right there." I said, "They'll take pictures. This will be big time, man. They'll be in every news program and sports program." You know, I said, So I found myself during that game that night about five different times setting myself up to scoop him up and slam him. It's like, and then I would stop at the last, no, I can't do it, I can't do it. And then I would come back to it again and again. But
you could have at least done a clothesline or something.
Yeah.
One of your famous drop kicks. Yeah.
I think the slam would have been great because he had those long legs and he's 7 foot two, you know, and it's easy to scoop slam somebody because they're running and they run right up into your body and into your grasp. I mean, you just lower your body a little bit and run that hand down there between their legs and then one up over their shoulder and they run up on your body, right? You got him up there. I could just see it. Now he's up there. His long legs are sticking out about 4 feet across on my back and then his body out the front side and a big old slam, wham! It would make a hell of a noise. I was like, wow, I just might have to do it. So dad really put me in funny positions and that would have been one of the nasty ones for me. That's for darn sure.
You know, last episode, you talked about your first match and you talked about a little bit about how after the match happened, your grandfather and your father, it's not that they weren't very complimentary, but they weren't the type to throw around big compliments after something like that. I was wondering, because your father took such an interest in basketball, you know, he ended up getting a place in Miami. And obviously, from what you're saying here today, he was really invested in what you were doing. He really seemed to love it. Was it different? Was he more complimentary? How into it was he while you were playing basketball in Miami?
Well, in the old days, when I first started playing, I never played basketball until the ninth grade. And in the ninth grade, I started playing basketball. And he never liked it. He never wanted me to play. And he always said, you're just going to be skinny and you'll look bad. You won't have any body. You won't have any size to you. You're not going to be a wrestler. You can't be a wrestler and be a basketball player. That was his whole concept. And he never came to any games until I became a senior in high school, started getting really good and building a name for myself. And he started showing up to these games. As time went on, he started to get more into the sport. And he decided, I guess it wasn't that much unrelated to wrestling, but he never really liked basketball. He never liked me playing. I think he liked to go and watch the games. He liked the fact that he didn't care whether I scored 10 points or if I didn't score any points. If I did something on there that got the crowd standing up or fired people up or I became some type of heel, then he was into that. It was like, yeah, I like that. That was good. That was good. So he was a little strange about it.
And then by the time you played UCLA, I believe that would have been by the time Lou Alcindor had been drafted by Milwaukee. So you missed a chance to play against him. And we later know him as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, but I think maybe the most underrated great player in NBA history, but he was a sensation in college. And it's one thing to look back now and acknowledge how great he was. I'm curious, in that time, although you didn't get to play against him, what did you guys say? What did the people who played against him say about him at that time?
Oh, I did not, like you said, I did not get to play against him, but I like most fans, especially if you were in college, you were really into the game the year before in which Houston and Elvin Hayes played. They played in the Astrodome and they played UCLA, one of the biggest basketball games of all time, probably. And they actually beat UCLA, which didn't happen very often. But yeah, I mean, you knew these names. And when you went to play out there in UCLA, and this is another thing that I was not a good influence. We were in LA. I wanted to go to the beach. Okay. Now we're playing UCLA, right? We fly in there at like 11 o'clock in the morning and the coach says, okay, we're going to have dinner here at 5 or whatever it is. And y'all can do what you want to do. So I told the guys, I said, let's go to the beach. And it was wintertime, right? And it was, they were having a storm in the Pacific and there were huge waves that day. So we go to Playa del Rey. It's a little beach, not too far from the airport. We catch cabs. I talked 10 guys into going with me, the whole team practically. Instead of resting in our beds to play in the national championship team, we go out and they all get scraped and banged up. We body surf. I get them out there body surf. They don't know anything about it. I don't either. And these waves are 10 or 12 feet. They're just crashing us head first into the sand and just tearing hide off our backs. And we got to the game that night, and the coach is like, "What in the hell did y'all do this afternoon? What's wrong with your back there? What's wrong with your arm there? What's that on your forehead, man?" It was like everybody had some kind of mark. "Oh, well, we went to the beach." "And well, how did you get hurt like that at the beach?" "Well, we got out there and body surfed." So we didn't prepare ourselves for the game. We played that team. It was now, I think what happened is they won national championship prior to Alcindor. They won three with Alcindor. I come in the next year. After Alcindor's gone, I'm there. They have one of the greatest teams I ever saw. When I went on the court, I was amazed that we played against Sidney Wicks and Curtis Rowe. Those were huge forwards. They were supposed to be, I looked at the program sitting in the dressing room, and they're 6'6", right? 6'6", 210 pounds. When we went out there to jump the ball, they were taller than I was. They were 6'10". They were at least 6'10", and they probably weighed 250. I mean, those guys were monsters. I was like, geez, man, what happened to this 6'6", 210 thing, man? I mean, these guys are just... And so they had those two great forwards. They had Henry Bibby, who became a huge star, John Vallalee. It was a phenomenal team. And the center was a guy named Steve Patterson that I played against. He was the guy I was playing against that night. And I had a pretty decent night against Patterson. He was no Alcindor. But the rest of that team had much better players than any of their forwards and any of their guards at that point.
You caught him right in between Alcindor and Bill Walton.
There you go. I had that year which they had, and they went on and won the national championship that year. And since we talked about Jacksonville, oddly enough, they come to the NCAA tournament, and the finals is Jacksonville against UCLA. Now, I'd done played both of them. I'd played both of their centers, and I'd had two experiences already with Artis Gilmore. Two times I had played against him. So it was great to watch that national championship game because I was so familiar with those guys. And that was a great game and a great team. I mean, Wooden went out there, and for 10 or 11 years, I mean, he was the man in college basketball, undoubtedly.
Maybe the greatest coach of all time, yeah.
Yeah, it's just I've just really enjoyed it. Overall, my college career, I enjoyed playing basketball. I love the traveling and seeing the country. We played in so many different cities. That college atmosphere, that college athletics, the scholarship, and, you know, there's good and bad of that. I used to wake up every morning, and I'll never forget it. They used to stamp your sheets, and it said property of the University of Miami. I'd wake up and I would look at my sheet, and it would say property of the University of Miami. And I would say, that's me. I am the property of the University of Miami. So, you know, but it's a great experience to do the college thing. And my biggest regret is not graduating. I had another year of eligibility. I could have played 1970, 71, and I did not go back. I started wrestling because Rob was already wrestling. My brother was wrestling. Jimmy was wrestling. Lester Welch's two sons, Roy Lee and Jackie, were both wrestling. The Fields boys had a couple of young kids that were starting to wrestle, and I felt like I was getting behind. And when I come home, Rob would make it worse. He would say, "Look," he said, "I got pretty decent payoff last night, man. You know, let me buy you a steak, brother." You know, and I'd say, "Well, I don't have any money, Rob." He said, "That's okay. You don't have to. I'm going to pick up your tab." You know, he goes, "Someday you'll make money too, Rob." You know, and I would go, "What the hell with you, Rob?" Of course I will, man. I'll make more than you when I get started. No, but they were ribbing me all the time about it. Jimmy too. Rob and Jimmy were both making money, and they were starting to wrestle. And so it was, but my career in college was good. I enjoyed my time there. But next episode that we have here, I'm going to start into my actual career. We're going to start talking about getting booked in Georgia and where I started wrestling. Rob and I together mostly. We worked a lot of tags, which is what you do traditionally. If you don't have much experience in the ring, it's always easier when you're green to have a partner, to have somebody that can step in there, pick up things when you're doing something that you shouldn't, or you're doing something wrong, or, you know, so it's going to become, we're going to get really, Brian, to the point where we're going to talk wrestling in my career and Rob's career and Jimmy's career. The third generation of Welches are about to take off, and we'll be able, from this point on, I think a pretty well done basketball here, a pretty well finished what happened in my last 2 years. And I'm ready at this point to become a professional wrestler.
This is the 31st episode, and it's amazing to think that in these 31 episodes, we haven't even begun to touch on your career, Robert's career, your career as a promoter, and so much more. Before we move on from this, I have one question for you, Ron. Of course, you would have great success owning hockey teams. You owned a couple of minor league hockey teams and really took a lot of the things you saw in professional wrestling that worked and applied them to hockey, and in many ways revolutionized hockey, something that a lot of teams in the NHL later adopted. I'm curious if you think there was ever anything there, if you could have taken some of what you took from wrestling and applied it to basketball, considering your background in college basketball.
Well, you know, wrestling changed. When I was in high school, I mean, and in college too, at the same time, wrestling was totally different. I mean, there were a lot of shooters. There were a lot of guys that really knew how to wrestle. There was no music. There was no intros. In fact, a lot of guys didn't even want to wear jackets or robes. You know, I remember Lou Thesz would come to wrestle and he would take a towel to the ring. You know, it was like there was no showmanship to the sport back in the early 70s like there would be along in the mid 80s and beyond that. So I couldn't have, you know, I couldn't have changed what they did. But I'm pretty sure, you know, that they do that now. I'll bet you, and I'm sure that the pros do. I know the pros, they have their intros and they have their openings to their games. And that's kind of what I did for hockey, is because they had no intros, and hockey was a very conservative sport. I never saw such a conservative sport. And the first time I ever did that intro in Nashville and darkened my building and turned on a spotlight and played bad to the bone, I had two NHL people there that ran teams, and they wanted to see what we did. And they let me know after the first period that they didn't like it. You know, they came into the office and said, "What in the hell are y'all doing?" And I said, "What do you mean? What are we doing? You can't do that." I said, "The hell I can. I own the damn team." I go, "I can do anything I want to. This is an East Coast. This ain't the NHL, guys. This is the East Coast League." I said, "We're going to do whatever it takes to draw and put asses in these seats in Nashville to watch hockey." And I said, "We're going to entertain them, man." And I asked him, I said, "You two guys saw the intro?" "Yeah, it was horrible." I said, "How many people were sitting down?" And then they looked at each other and they thought about it and they go, "Well, none of them were sitting down." I go, "All right." I said, "Then I accomplished what the hell I wanted to, didn't I?" I said, "I'm going to entertain them. I'm going to stand them up every time I can. And they're going to learn hockey. And within a few months here, they'll be coming to watch hockey. Right now, they're coming to watch what I'm going to give them. And I'm going to give them something good every week." So it did have a big effect on hockey. And hockey now is just, I watch it now. I'm a big fan here. I live in Tampa, and one of the best hockey teams in the world. This year, they're really kicking butt. They're going to win the Stanley Cup, is my prediction. They're going to get the cup this year. And they do stuff far beyond anything we ever did. I just love it. I watch their intros and I go, "Wow, these guys are good. They got it going, man." So yeah, I did have some effect on that game, for certain, for certain.
It's come a long way, and so have we, actually, here on the Studcast this week. Ron, before we wrap things up, I do want to tell everyone, because I have been hearing a great reaction from people on the Mothership group, on the 605 Super Podcast page, people really enjoying the Super Studcast. Of course, if you're listening to this, this is the normal Studcast. The Super Studcast is available to patrons of this show, and you can become one by going to patreon.com/studcast or tnstud.com for only $2.99 a month. You get access to a bonus Super Studcast. Take this episode, double it, and it's all on one special topic, as well as a return. The rest of the story, an additional hour on that topic. The Andre the Giant ones have received great acclaim. And next, and people are going to go crazy about this, Ron Wright. Everyone loves your impression of Ron Wright. Everyone loves these stories of the chisel. You've only told a little bit of those stories on podcasts and in interviews. Now you're going to really tell the whole story on the Super Studcast, Ron.
Yes, that's and gosh, Brian, I mean, I love it. And I've been doing a little social media and saying the second subject and the second topic is going to be Ron Wright. And I get people, especially anybody that knows Ron Wright, that go, wow, man, I won't miss this one. Ron Wright, to me, is one of the most fantastic, unforgettable characters I've ever been around in wrestling. And he's got that voice, boy, and he don't mind turning that East Tennessee dog whooping loose on you. You know, and I plan on doing that pretty much the whole show. I'm going to imitate him, and I hope that the fans will consider it a form of flattery. I really love this guy. He was an unbelievable character, and you can't hardly do him without doing some imitation of his voice. And I just, that's going to be a tremendous Super Studcast. I think people, and there's so many people out there that don't know Ron Wright. They have no concept of who this guy is. But once they hear these stories, it's kind of like the story I told on Jim's program about the zoo. And I've had more people, on social media send me stuff about that zoo story. You know, about that. Somebody sent me a huge gorilla that was dressed in a girl's outfit and called him Ginger. They said, "This is Ginger, right?" So, you know, I really had a lot of fun with that. I've had a lot of fun with the making this Ron Wright program, and I just consider him a wonderful person, and he's not with us anymore. And this is my tribute to Ron, and I think people, after they hear it, they're going to do what someone sent me about that, the monkey story in the zoo in Australia, and they said, "I told that story to my friends that night." You know, so they went back and told those same stories. They're going to talk and tell these Ron Wright stories. So I would love to have you join us there. Get on that Patreon, become a patron of the program, and get the Super Studcast and the rest of the story. And that Super Studcast comes on the 11th of February. That's right. 2 weeks later, on the 25th, is the rest of the Ron Wright story, in which you'll have an opportunity to answer questions and to ask questions. In fact, on the 11th and the 12th of February, I'm going to go on Facebook. You can go to my site at Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud, that's spelled out, Tennessee Stud, and you can leave me questions that you have about that didn't get answered about Ron Wright, and I will come back then on that rest of the Ron Wright story on the 25th and answer those questions, and we'll give you another hour, 3 hours for $2.99. I think it's probably not a bad buy, as most of the people that have taken it and really enjoy it.
And it's a great way to support this show. If you enjoyed this show, you will certainly enjoy the Super Studcast and the rest of the story, both available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. A few other news and notes here at the end of the show. You can follow Ron on Twitter by following at Ron Fuller Welch, and that's the same address. You can follow him on Instagram. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last, and you can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcasts. If you are on Facebook, just like Ron said a little earlier, like him, like his page, Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud, spell out the word Tennessee. This program is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud, I'm the Great Brian Last. Until next time, tally-ho!
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.